I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. We're kicking off 2009 with a slice of history and a look into the future of city planning. First, we'll speak with John Geraci. John has spent the last 6 years making life in cities better using web technologies. He's here to tell us about his latest project, DIY City, a site dedicated to finding ways technology can make cities work efficiently, effectively, and sustainably. Plus, a look back on the past. The 70s and 80s were turbulent times for New York City, but an iconic image, the I Heart New York symbol, went from slogan to a way of life. We'll speak with author and sociologist Miriam Greenberg about her book, Branding New York. All that, plus our regular contributors Nate Berg and Walker Smith coming up on today's Smart City. But first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Virtually every day, a new application or technology is released to the web. Our first guest, John Geraci, was looking to harness those tools to make cities better and created DIY City. DIY City is a web community that taps into the wisdom of the crowd to make cities more efficient, more effective, and more sustainable. John, what are you trying to accomplish with DIY City?
Well, DIY City is a site that invites everyone to reimagine their city and reinvent their city as something that's more efficient and more effective and more sustainable using web technology that's freely available to everybody.
Tell me more. What does that look like then in your reality?
In my reality? Well, there's a couple things happening right now in the world. Everybody's getting mobile devices, everybody's getting online, and there's a lot of platforms being built on the web that enable really easy transfer of information, really easy access of large data banks. And then at the same time, governments are starting to play with this information as well and starting to think about opening up these data sets. And so when you put those two things together, you get a situation where people can access government records, they can communicate with each other about situations in a city, and when you build on all that together, you can create a city with a system where everybody's plugged in and talking to each other, and the system is more efficient than current city infrastructure.
When did you launch DIY City?
Just 7 weeks ago, so very, very fresh.
It's very, very fresh. Now, I love the idea, John, but for how long do you have to seed this site with your own ideas, with sort of talking to yourself until before people begin to really jump in and participate?
Yeah, there's always a little bit of seeding and self-dialogue, you know, with any site that you launch. That's just an inherent part of it. I'm actually really surprised at the response that I got right away from people all over the world with just the very limited exposure that the site has had. I've had sign-ups of people from incredible variety of walks of life. I mean, professors of urban planning, city agency workers from cities around the world, computer programmers, programmer designers. So it's getting quite a response. And people are still, I think, waiting to see where it's going to go and what direction it's going to go. And we're having a global meetup in mid-January with all the cities that are where people are participating. And we're all going to meet individually in groups in these cities and create a roadmap for where we're going to go.
Well, I saw that on your site. That's January 14th, and I know you've got at least one meetup in New York. Where are the other meetups, domestically or in Canada?
So far, we've got meetups scheduled in San Francisco, New York, and Paris. All the groups are pretty small at this point. The site's only 7 weeks old, but it looks like we'll be able to get a meetup maybe going in Sao Paulo, in Copenhagen, in one or two other international cities, London maybe.
Yeah, that's exciting. Now, why DIY City is an online community? Why get people together offline, in person?
Yeah, I mean, the site is so in its infancy that I started several sites, and it's always sort of an open question as to what's really going to make it cross over that tipping point and take off. And it feels like just getting people together and talking in person is a great way to really make a connection with people, share ideas in a very fast way, and come to a sort of common agreement on what direction we should move in.
You offered a challenge recently on the site to design a ride-sharing app that works. What problems would those apps have to solve if they were to really work in the way you imagine?
First of all, DIY City, if nothing else, has been an incredible learning experience for me. Because a lot of people who are much smarter than I am about these very specific niches are online posting things. And so I posted something saying, let's build a ride-sharing app that works. It shouldn't be that hard. I've seen several that don't work, and I have a pretty good idea why that is. I think that we could reasonably make one on Facebook or something, and that would work very well. Got a pretty good level of response from people who have done a lot of studying on this subject. And so it turns out there's a lot of barriers to ride sharing. Let me see if I can, I don't think I'll be able to remember them all. First one is critical mass. You know, if there's only five people using a ride sharing system, it doesn't work. And so nobody's going to bother going to it. And that's a really big problem because ride sharing is such a local thing. So I'm right now on West 20th Street in New York, and I need to go to Brooklyn. How many other people out there in the world have that same situation? How many of them are using the same app as me? So that's really the big one. Trust of the people that you're potentially sharing a ride with is a huge one. What are some others? The list is long. If you go to the site, you can see them all posted pretty clearly.
Now, I remember Robin Chase, who founded Zipcar.
Zipcar and GoLoco, yes.
That's right. GoLoco is essentially a ride-sharing program.
Right, right, yeah.
But it doesn't quite work?
Well, it hasn't worked yet. I think they haven't gotten all the bugs out, just like everybody hasn't. I think one problem that a lot of these platforms and applications out there that are trying to do good things like ride sharing or whatnot, part of the problem is that they're creating a walled garden because it's a for-profit model. They're saying, well, this is a company, and so you have to sign in, you have to use our platform, we have to be able to serve ads to you or whatever, we have to be able to have some sort of transaction. And the premise for DIY City is that these tools are really ready to explode and be used by people, but they have to be open source, they have to be free, it has to be something that people can install in their local areas as they see fit.
Well, you say that people have submitted a number of things in terms of research, so it's made you smarter about what's out there and what doesn't work or what's wrong with them, what needs to be fixed. Has anyone submitted anything yet that you think is promising?
Not entirely. I kind of backed off that one because it just seemed like such a hornet's nest, but I do feel like there's a lot of posts on the site about that, and I feel like if we go back and comb through it, we can come up with something that's pretty good. I mean, a lot of what this is crowdsourcing, just throwing a question out to people and saying, what do you think? And then the experts write in, and you can sort of pick through the answers and assemble the thing you like.
Okay, ride sharing is one example of a problem that people have, or it's a solution to a problem that people have in cities. And certainly, if you could lick that problem, you would make cities more efficient. What are other kinds of problems that you've thought about that DIY City might take on?
Transportation is really the low-hanging fruit here, because what we're looking at is new ways of coordinating massive amounts of people and massive amounts of things moving through a city. That's a common problem here. So three cities, San Francisco, Portland, and Chicago have just opened up APIs for their public transit systems. So what that means is anybody with a computer can hit their server and get up-to-the-minute information about their public transit. That's a huge potential DIY city boon right there. What you could do with that is write applications that put in the palm of everybody's hands when their next bus is coming or when their next train is coming or whether a train is delayed or whether a bus has been rerouted because of an accident. And things like that translate to better coordination, people moving through the city more easily and avoiding hotspots. So that's a pretty easy one, and that's happening right now as we speak.
Tell me the three cities again, Portland?
Yeah, Portland, Chicago, and San Francisco.
Well, why am I not using this to figure out when the next bus is coming? That is the most irritating thing, to get to a bus stop or a train stop and wonder, if only I'd arrived 1 minute earlier, I could have avoided a 10-minute wait.
Right. Well, it's very new. I mean, these APIs just opened up very recently, and it's still sort of anybody's guess as to how that's going to be built on. And then there's always the problem of adoption. You know, once you build something, how do you get it in people's hands and get the message out to them that these tools exist? So there are multiple hoops that you have to jump through to build this sort of ideal city, but I think it'll happen eventually.
You recently wrote an entry on the site lauding David Brooks' column in the New York Times, where he called for President-elect Obama's stimulus package to include a dramatic, innovative rethink of U.S. urban living patterns. I thought that was a fabulous column, too. But you then ask some questions. What role could a community like DIY City play in achieving that innovation, in helping to define the vision for that innovation, in energizing people to make that innovation happen in their communities on their own, with or without the aid and assistance of government offices? Did you come up with any answers?
Well, I mean, those were questions that I already have my own personal answers to, and I don't know if anybody else agrees with them or not, but I feel personally that, you know, there's this conversation going on right now about whether the stimulus package should fund one gigantic thing or whether it should fund a million people in their garages doing things. And I'm of the camp that believes that a million people in their garages will come up with better ideas, especially nowadays because innovation, the cost of innovation is just dropping so much. And so I hope that Obama and his cabinet are going to support community innovation and not try and drive innovation from within Washington. I think they will. I just think that's a more innovative way to go about it, and I think you'll get better results that way.
Do you see something like that coming out of the stimulus package? I keep imagining that we're going to have a million road builders. I wish that were funny. At this point, I don't feel it's so funny.
Well, yeah, I sort of just assumed naively that we would see something like that, and then I read David Brooks' column. I got a little bit worried. I thought, whoa, maybe this is going to be just a new computer in some classrooms or something. So I think the message will get out to Obama. I know that there are a lot of people working on this problem, a lot of very smart people, people who are more connected than I am. I have a open invitation to whoever Obama's CTO is to have a conversation about this when he gets home.
Well, let me ask you this. How would you, if you were advising Senator Obama directly, how would you put that sort of money or support or resources out there so that it would get used in the way you imagine it being used? How could it, in fact, support a million people in their garages working on innovations?
I think if you look at what Google has done with Google.org, Google is a for-profit company. They opened up a nonprofit arm that gives out grants based on the subjects that they want to see pushed forward. This is getting out of my realm because I'm very much not a policy person. I think it would be pretty easy to set up some sort of body that would function a little bit like a seeding company or a venture capital company, only government-sponsored, that would sort of identify people with promising ideas and give them a little sum of money to try and build that into something.
That's fair enough. This is not your first online venture. You are also co-founder of Outside In. What's the concept of Outside In?
Outside.in is a site that aggregates news, local news, and shows you all the news that's happening right around you, wherever you are right now. So if you are in downtown St. Louis, we show you the news that's happening in downtown St. Louis right now. And what we're doing is we're combing through newspaper feeds online and blog feeds and a lot of other kind of feeds and just sorting them all by location. So it just takes all the current content on the web and organizes it by location. The result is sort of a local newspaper for everybody.
Now, of course, traditional local newspapers are very much in the news these days, mainly because they're filing bankruptcy or cutting staffs in severe ways. How are local online news sites like Outside.in affecting local traditional media like newspapers and television?
Well, we see ourselves as part of the solution for them. We're not trying to be competitors with them or undercut them in any way. We're actually doing a lot of our biggest partnerships with an increasing number of newspapers right now. They're looking for ways to cut costs and deliver the same kind of quality news, but do it more cheaply because they have no choice but to do that. So we see ourselves as helping pave the way towards the new news reality.
The new news reality, which is what?
Well, that's anybody's question right now because it hasn't been defined, but it's definitely going to be more diffused. It's not going to be big newsrooms of 40 reporters all typing away simultaneously on stories. It's going to be some sort of more networked structure. You know, if you look at Huffington Post, they're doing a great job of creating the new newspaper of the future, which is maybe 40% stories that they've written themselves and 60% aggregated stories from around the web. And by the way, we just partnered with them to provide local news for Huffington Post. So I feel like that's as good as a model I've seen so far for the future of news.
It may be, at this point, the only model that seems to be working.
It's really kind of a running battle right now. I mean, check back in 6 months and there might be a totally different story.
Can you put yourself in the place of a local newspaper editor? Let's say the Detroit News or the Detroit Free Press, which just announced that they're going to cut home delivery back to either back to 3 days a week or I think back to 3 days a week, which is hard for me to imagine. But, you know, I'm online all the time. I read several newspapers every day. I get nervous if my newspaper's not at my door when I wake up. So, you know, I guess I'm old-fashioned in that way. And yet, I'm online all day. So I do both. I realize a lot of people don't. Can you put yourself in the place of a newspaper editor? And what would you be doing today, knowing what you know about local news? And you know a lot about local news.
There are no easy answers. And I think on a personal level, for those people who are working those jobs, it's a very sad story. It's a story that we've seen a lot of different times when any kind of industry shifts with new technology. And so for that editor, I would think they've got to be thinking about the future and knowing that these certain changes are inevitable just because the technology mandates that these changes will happen and the market mandates that they'll happen. So there are no easy answers for them, but I'm sure they're looking ahead and trying to figure out what their next plan is going to be.
When you think about Outside.in, take the Governor Blagojevich story in Illinois, take the Long Island Railroad pension story in New York that the New York Times has really broken and stayed on top of. Don't we risk losing those sorts of stories if we lose local newspapers? Can organizations like Outside.in or Huffington Post ever produce that kind of journalism?
To your first question, don't we risk losing them? Absolutely we do. And we are not pushing for that to happen. I love good investigative journalism as much as anybody else. And I am not looking forward to the day that the New York Times or whoever goes under. But on the other hand, there are new models that are starting to bubble up now that are still untested and they're not mature, but they're happening. There's a site called spot.us, just launched a few weeks ago, where what they're doing is they're soliciting payments from people who want to see a story researched, and then that payment goes to the person who suggested the story, and they go and write the story. So there are other models. I'm pretty confident that investigative journalism won't go away. It's just going to happen in a different way.
And so 7 weeks into DIY City, let's move down the road a year. What will need to have happened to make you feel like it's been worth it?
I'm looking at week 8 right now. I don't know about a year from now. But I was just saying to somebody the other day that when I started DIY City, I felt like there was a good idea there and I didn't know exactly what it was. But I always feel that the way to nail the good idea is just launch it and start doing it and fix it as you go along. And I feel like the good idea, the sweet spot is starting to emerge, which is that a lot of these ideas are being tried around the country and around the world on a very local level. You know, how do we use this web application to inform people about traffic better? Or how do we use that web application to coordinate waste removal better or something? And those are happening, but those people aren't talking to each other and everybody's operating in a vacuum. And what we need is some sort of national dialogue or international, global dialogue about this and how we can do this best. And then we need to be sharing resources and sharing code and not building walled gardens saying, this is my for-profit model and you have to come sign up for my site, but saying, here's my code. This is the way we did it in San Francisco. You guys do this in Tucson. You know, apply it the way you want. And I feel like that's where I want to be in a year with this is DIY City is a platform for every community in the world to take code as they need it and put back code and offer improvements on models.
Well, it's exciting. John, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
All right. Thanks a lot.
John Geraci is the founder of DIYCity.org. If you want to contribute to the community or see the ideas floating around, we've got a link to his site on ours, smartcityradio.com. His interview was engineered by the Argo Network in New York. And now for the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
$1 trillion could stimulate a lot of things. President-elect Barack Obama is hopeful that his plan to inject nearly $1 trillion stimulus dollars into the U.S. economy will result in a nationwide infrastructure of the future. He's calling for an all-around reinvention of the nation's infrastructure on a scale even grander than the interstate highway system of the 1950s, along with increased spending for new energy, better bridges, and more public transit. Unfortunately, fresh ideas for how to use this stimulus money are in short supply. According to an article from Bloomberg, states like Missouri, Arizona, and Utah plan to use the majority of their share to maintain old roads and build new ones, exactly the old infrastructure Obama's plan seeks to move away from. If road projects end up receiving the bulk of the stimulus money in other states, many fear that the country won't be able to move beyond its 1950s-era infrastructure, or the suburban landscape it enabled. And while the U.S. struggles to move on from this suburban style, other countries are trying hard to emulate it, and many are succeeding. A recent article from the Huffington Post looks at the increasing trend of U.S. architects and planners finding more work overseas, and more demand for the American dream-style housing and retail development that defines the U.S. From housing tracts in Beijing to shopping malls in Bahrain, Americans and their development patterns are getting a lot of play in emerging economies. And while the American architects and planners working abroad say they're trying to build more eco-friendly developments, many urban experts worry that American suburban problems are simply moving overseas. And finally, one of America's distinctly suburban metropolises took a step towards urbanity this past week. Phoenix, Arizona has just opened a 20-mile light rail line, servicing the city and its nearby suburbs. According to a recent report on National Public Radio, crowds lined up for hours to ride the new train, which had been in the works for more than 10 years. Cities hosted parties at their local stations as the trains made their first trips through the car-dominated Phoenix area. With more than 4 million people living in the region, the expected 26,000 daily riders of the light rail line will clear only a fraction of the cars off the road. But, as many Phoenix residents say, this is just the first step. For Plan Edison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor for PlanEdison.com. Coming up after the break, we'll speak with author and sociologist Miriam Greenberg. She'll tell us about the history of New York, not as a city, but as a brand. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Hello to our podcast listeners. I just had a quick note about some of the conversations that are happening on our social networking site, My City. Our listeners are continuing to talk about the topics we bring up on the show, from rent control to mass transit, from your favorite online urbanism tools to why you choose to live in the city in the first place. My City is a place where people who love cities can meet and chat and get great new ideas. Please join us. Send an email to our producer, Scotty Iseri, at scotty@smartcityradio.com. He'll get you all set up. And now back to the show. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. A city's image can sometimes be more powerful than the reality. No city understands this better, perhaps, than New York, which throughout the 70s and 80s dealt with economic and image challenges. Miriam Greenberg is an author and professor of sociology at the University of California at Santa Cruz. She's written a book about the history of New York City and how the slogan, "I love New York," came to mean more than just a logo on a T-shirt. Describe New York City's brand today.
Well, New York City's brand today has built upon what was established, I would say, 30 years ago with the Big Apple and the I Love New York campaign, which were campaigns that sought to market the city to global consumers, tourists, folks interested in purchasing real estate and moving to the city, people interested in setting up corporate headquarters in the city through universal campaigns that sold the very hip and urbane qualities of the city, as well as the idea that New York was a place for 24-hour fun and a place where Wall Street was located in a very profitable location. And I think today the new New York City and Company marketing agency has sought to market New York in a broader scale, not only focusing on the Broadway and Wall Street and Manhattan, but really the five boroughs and the possibilities for, again, real estate and tourism throughout the broader metropolitan area.
Did the attempt to brand New York with the I Love New York and the Big Apple, did that precede the cleanup of New York, or did it follow the cleanup of New York?
It preceded and followed. The first sort of quasi-official marketing campaign was Big Apple, which began in 1971, which was really, you know, you could argue during the period of the decline financially of the city, but the real nadir of the fiscal crisis was in 75. And at that point, the Big Apple campaign was put on hiatus, and there was a regrouping, and the larger scale, larger scope of I Love New York was mounted by both people at the city level and the state level. And that coincided with both the worst point of the fiscal crisis and what I would call the image crisis of the city, and then built up over the course of the following decade during the quote-unquote recovery of the city.
You make the point in your book that the importance of branding didn't just occur to someone one day, that it was, in fact, the transformation of the economy to a knowledge economy and to a global economy that accelerated the need for branding. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think that there had been a lot of, you know, clamoring for more coordinated marketing coming from the Convention and Visitors Bureau, or what is now New York City and Company, coming from, you know, the tourist and real estate sectors for quite a while. And there had been kind of resistance to this. New York City's economy was very diverse. New York City had a very vibrant media sector that put out images of the city internationally without any kind of coordinated effort by the public and private sector working together on this. But in the late 60s and early 70s, with, as you're saying, this shift to a global economy that was oriented much more towards image-sensitive sectors, like tourism, like, you know, what you're referring to as the knowledge economy, the service sector more broadly, there was a realization that if New York City was to make this shift, this kind of post-industrial shift, it was going to require that the city focus much more intensively on image marketing, and a concerted branding effort began based on that assumption.
It's always interesting to compare what a company like a McDonald's or a Coke or a Nike can do with branding versus a city. A Nike controls its product. It derives revenue from its product, so it has plenty of money to advertise. Most cities really cannot sustain a paid advertising campaign, at least over, they can start one, they can't finish one. So you have to employ different tools than advertising. You can't really rely on it. So what are the ways in which New York conveyed its brand?
Well, I think that I should preface this with explaining my sort of definition of branding, which actually I think follows a lot the kind of corporate model of branding, which is one that's both focused on image making and advertising on the one hand, but also on the restructuring of the company, as it were, or the, in this case, the city, so the political and economic restructuring of the city. So, you know, the intensive use of marketing by companies like Nike or Coca-Cola coincided with the offshoring of production and the cheapening of labor in those companies. Similarly, for New York, the intensification of marketing coincided with the instigation of all of these austerity measures, which involved cutting the labor force of the city, lowering municipal worker salaries, cutting social services, and so forth. And so there was a similar kind of cost-benefit analysis and intensifying of marketing, which relative to other expenses is indeed cheaper, let's say, than social services. But on the other hand, spending more money on marketing at the same time as cutting spending in the municipal budget. In that sense, it was easy to argue to the legislature that while money was being spent on marketing, it wasn't to such an extent that it was scaring the legislators at a time when money was being cut from pretty much every single other aspect of public spending. In addition, the question of how they can sustain marketing over time is a good one. One of the ways involves working with companies and the media sector to pick up on the brand and to carry it over in their own marketing. So, and we see that actually, we saw that in the 70s and the period that I'm writing about. I think we see that even more intensively today when there's all these co-sponsorships that go on between the city of New York and, let's say, Sony Pictures or Disney, and they have these co-branded events and products that involve the branded version of New York City along with, let's say, the Spider-Man 3 movie. And a week is devoted to the Spider-Man 3 movie throughout the five boroughs at the same time that the Spider-Man franchise is marketing the New York City skyline and various destinations within New York. And so that's a way of maximizing public dollars spent on marketing through the private sector.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Miriam Greenberg, author of the book Branding New York. I remember previous marketers of New York complaining about the effect that shows like NYPD Blue had on New York, but then I quickly think about poor Baltimore, which had Homicide, Life on the Street, and then subsequently The Wire, and where the streets are shown as far more brutal than anything NYPD Blue or Law and Order would show. I mean, it was portrayed more as culture. So you mentioned Spider-Man, which it would be a happy note for portraying New York, but certainly some cities have been plagued, I guess including New York, but some cities have been plagued with a really negative depiction in film or on television. How do you think that plays into perception of cities?
Well, this was a huge issue beginning really in the 1960s in New York. I mean, one of the things that was really fascinating that I found through my research was that while almost all the other sectors, you know, sort of traditional industrial sectors, manufacturing sectors, commercial, tourism, so forth, were declining in New York, one of the areas of growth was in media. And there was this resurgence of shooting on the street, on location in New York City. This was spurred to some extent by the creation of the Mayor's Office of Film, Television, and Broadcasting, the return of filmmakers to New York, the new Hollywood directors coming back to New York to shoot on location. And so there was this explosion of films shot about New York City, most of which I dub in this period, let's say, between the 60s through the mid-70s, asphalt jungle kinds of films, many of which were critical successes like Midnight Cowboy, the Scorsese films like Taxi Driver and so forth, and shot often by New York City directors and with New York City actors, but increasingly by the mid-70s, by Hollywood directors making what might be considered B-movies. And there's a shift, I argue, from kind of asphalt jungle representations, which were more complex, gritty, kind of urban films, to what I call New York City exploitation films, which were often just very gruesome, brutal, often racist kinds of films, films by like Fear City, Fort Apache, The Bronx, that used location shooting, often burnt out sections of the city like the South Bronx, neighborhoods in Brooklyn, and would purposely try to degrade the environment where they were shooting to make it as gruesome as possible, and played into what was, I think, an emerging fear nationwide, particularly with the suburbanization of the country in this period and the shifting of federal funds from cities to suburbs, the rising conservative movement, which was often quite anti-urban, that New York City was kind of the epitome of the urban crisis and that New York City deserved, you know, kind of the treatment that it was getting from the federal government. We'll remember the famous Ford to City drop dead, you know, the idea that New York City didn't deserve to be, quote, bailed out from its fiscal crisis, that it brought its problems on itself, that it was this kind of cesspool, and that because of its social problems, it had dragged the economy down and so forth. And that was really powerfully portrayed in a number of films, tens of films shot annually in the latter part of the 70s and early 80s in the city. And that contributed to what I term this kind of image crisis that the city was dealing with. And so I do think that this was a period when we can argue that image making can have these kinds of broader political and economic effects on cities. Whether or not the reaction that the power brokers of the day chose was the right one is another question. But I do think that that image played a huge part in the political and economic fortunes of the city in this period and continues to do so.
And what role did they choose in terms of reacting to films that were not particularly positive toward New York?
I think that they responded sort of in kind. I mean, a lot of the problems that the city was undergoing were much deeper than what was being portrayed in these films. There was terrible devastation in the South Bronx. The way that was portrayed in Fort Apache, the Bronx, was in a very superficial way that really placed the blame on the poorest residents of the neighborhood. There were deeper structural economic forces behind the destruction of the South Bronx, the loss of jobs in the South Bronx, the flight of capital from the South Bronx. And that was not addressed in these films. And similarly, the reaction, the marketing-led response, branding response, I think sought to simply shift attention away from those outlying neighborhoods to focus the media's attention on the central city, to brand a counter image of New York that was very tourist and business friendly, that was mostly white, that was one that in many ways avoided or even erased the local cultures in the city, the diversity of the city, the rise of what many people argued were kind of homegrown cultural renaissance going on, for instance, with the rise of hip-hop in the South Bronx or a number of other artistic movements like salsa and disco and other things. These cultural phenomena that were kind of blotted out by the official branders, and instead a more Broadway-focused, Wall Street-focused campaign was what was launched to counter this thing, and that coincided with the restructuring I was referring to earlier that involved a lot of public sector cutbacks and tax breaks and rezoning and other things that were also targeted towards making the city more appealing to tourists and to corporations and Wall Street.
So do you personally view branding, and from an academic standpoint, do you view branding as an evil or as a negative, as a sleight of hand?
One thing I would just say is that image marketing per se, there's nothing wrong with, and I think there's actually an enormous amount of creativity involved. I interviewed Milton Glaser for this book, who was the artistic director of New York Magazine and ultimately the person who came up with the I Heart New York logo. I think he, as well as the folks at Wells Rich & Green, the advertising agency behind the campaign, were incredibly creative people, and that going back through advertising history, that's an important part of American popular culture. There's nothing wrong with trying to market a city or market any product for that matter. I think the issue that I encountered in doing this research was the extent to which this approach was very much associated with deeper forms of political and economic restructuring. And in that sense, you know, you could argue that it was a kind of a sleight of hand, or that it was certainly a means of distracting attention from these other changes, which were in many cases quite unpopular and controversial. What's interesting to me is that the marketing image was this kind of universal, even utopian kind of image of, you know, I love New York, this kind of solidarity with a struggling city that so many people identified with at this time. You know, they were forced to remember that despite stuff that they might be seeing in these movies and despite stuff that they might be hearing from commentators around the country or from the administration in Washington at the time, they loved New York, and they didn't want New York to fall into the sea or to be destroyed as some people imagine that it might be in this period. That was a beautiful thing. On the other hand, I think that solidarity and that sentiment was kind of harnessed to justify a shift in the city's political economy that was not universal, that excluded a lot of folks in the city and created a kind of two-tier economy that persists to this day.
Do you think, though, that it's possible to advance an idea like I love New York if most people don't love New York, or most New Yorkers don't love New York? In other words, if there is a lot of counter argument by the people who, in fact, live in the city?
That's an interesting question. It would be a lot harder. I mean, I think that what's the brilliance of artists like Milton Glaser is to tap into something that was really true. And post 9/11, he actually did a new form of the campaign, I Love New York, that was called I Love New York More Than Ever. I don't know if you saw any of that. I think it mostly circulated locally in New York City, and I'll tell you why in a second. But it was an image like the I Heart New York, but with a black mark on the lower left-hand sector of the heart to represent the spot in Manhattan where the towers had gone down. And it said, "I heart New York," with this black mark more than ever. And it was put on the back page of the Daily News. And so millions of copies were spread around the city and so forth. And people independently put that image up in their windows, and it created this kind of viral campaign similar to what occurred in the 70s with the original campaign, which I should mention was not copyrighted at that time and so was allowed to circulate widely around the world in many, many forms. So people wouldn't independently embrace that logo and that slogan if there wasn't a pre-existing feeling that it was tapping into, you could argue, and that it didn't help to articulate and didn't help to visualize. So what's interesting, though, and again, brings us to this issue of the kind of logic behind some of these campaigns, is that Milton Glaser was threatened with a lawsuit for creating this change to his logo because during the 1990s, there had been a different... There was a different regime in, at the state level in Albany that oversaw the brand of I Love New York and that no longer allowed for this kind of viral campaigning. Even the creator of the campaign himself was not allowed to tamper with it, particularly in a way that ran counter to what the effort was post 9/11 being launched by the Empire State Development Corporation in Albany, which was one that was trying to emphasize the resilience of the city as opposed to the wounded heart. They didn't want to show a wounded heart in this period, and so they were willing to take him to court.
Well, which sort of raises the whole question, who owns the brand? Who owns the brand of a city? Which comes back to what role do the people themselves, the people who live there, work there, what say do they have in the brand? Let me ask you one final question. You're taking a slice of history and interpreting it for us. What lessons should other cities that don't have the firepower, the media power, they're not the center of the global economy like New York, what lessons can other cities learn from your look at New York branding?
Well, I think a few things. I think that what's valuable potentially culturally about city marketing is the extent to which it really authentically represents local culture in a way that's as democratic as possible. I mean, obviously, in a city like New York or pretty much any other city, there's always a variety of cultures that are competing for attention. But I think that if you want to truly speak for your city, you need to try to bring as many folks together, not only from certain economic sectors, but from the city at large, to try to represent the complexity and the diversity of the city. And that was something that really was not achieved in the 70s, and I think to the detriment of the city, which to this day has a kind of tense relationship, for instance, with the role of hip-hop in its history, the role of graffiti, for instance, in its history, which internationally is seen as this major cultural force. But still, to this day in New York, there's a very tense relationship with the hip-hop culture and the hip-hop community, I think, unless you're talking about a figure like Jay-Z or, you know, a major corporate mogul. Underground hip-hop community and form of hip-hop that has traveled around the world as a cultural phenomenon, as an underground force, is something that the official branders have difficulty with. So the question of kind of cultural representation is one piece of it. Another piece is not to assume that image marketing in and of itself is going to solve your problems. I think that many of the problems that reared their heads in the 1970s, i.e. the economic and social problems that the crisis brought on, were not resolved ultimately by the branding solution and persisted over the next 30 years. And in fact, in some ways intensified, for instance, the class division in the city and the difficulty in integrating different populations into the workforce and into the economy. This created jobs in certain sectors, but not in others. It didn't help to diversify the economy. Another thing I would say is the increasing dependence that the branding solution placed on sectors like the financial industry and on tourism. And I think one of the things that we're seeing today in New York is that these are very volatile sectors. And when they go down and when you're as dependent as a city like New York is on these sectors, it can really drag the economy of the city as a whole down with it. And this is a kind of scary situation that New York is in now that many say is reminiscent not only to the 70s, but to the 1930s, the potential for a much wider recession or even depression in the city. And branding was really, if anything, if nothing else, it was an effort to peg the city's fortunes to those industries. I think that certain sectors definitely benefited from that, and those who were most behind the branding effort benefited from that. But we need to think of a much broader economic approach to urban development and to urban planning that includes a lot of different neighborhoods. One final point I would just say that can be learned from this is the question of gentrification and the extent to which branding was successful, I would argue, in raising the value of New York City real estate. But the question is, you know, who benefited from that, and how do we ensure that cities' fortunes are not only measured, the barometer for cities' fortunes is not simply the value of real estate, but also how affordable it is to middle class and working class folks trying to live in the city.
Miriam, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you very much.
Miriam Greenberg is a professor of sociology at University of California at Santa Cruz and the author of the book Branding New York, How a City in Crisis Was Sold to the World. Our interview was engineered by Maya Evans at KUSP. It's a whole new year, so is the economy any better yet? Just because we're out of the holiday season doesn't mean the season of giving should be over. Our City Views commentator Walker Smith brings us his proposal for an economic stimulus package.
Just before Christmas 1933, a notice appeared in the local Canton, Ohio newspaper. The writer, one B. Verdeau, asked readers to write in and describe their struggles. For the neediest, a small bit of money was promised to help tide them over through the holidays. Hundreds of letters poured into the general delivery box at the Canton Post Office, and soon thereafter small checks began to arrive at homes around the city. The newspaper did some digging and ran a story about the mysterious B. Verdeau. It said that he was a Canton businessman who wanted to remain anonymous. He had lost everything himself once, but had now recovered and wanted to use his money to help others. No one ever found out B. Verdeau's real identity, and he became a Canton legend. I learned of this story from an op-ed in the New York Times written by the grandson of the mysterious B. Verdeau. His mother had given him an old black suitcase that had been gathering dust in her attic. When he opened it, he discovered B. Verdeau's canceled checks and the pile of letters that people had sent to him. The published excerpts of these letters are heartrending, especially because there is so much of the same financial hardship being visited on people right now. B. Verdeau had come to America with his parents from Romania in order to escape persecution as Jews. He grew up in a Pittsburgh ghetto, rolling cigars instead of being able to go to school. He worked on a barge and in a coal mine. He later owned a clothing store that almost went bankrupt, but had finally found enough financial security by the time of the Great Depression to weather that storm. His grandson emphasized that B. Verdeau believed in hard work, but he also recognized that sometimes people need a helping hand to enable them to get by and revive their spirits. That's why B. Verdeau anonymously sent wool overcoats to British soldiers in World War II with a handwritten note in each pocket encouraging them and assuring them of America's support. As B. Verdeau's grandson reminds us, those of us secure enough to weather the current economic storm must not forget others. Food banks, homeless shelters, animal shelters, and more all need our help. It is, as he writes, quote unquote, a debt we owe one another and ourselves. But let me take it a step further. Here's my proposal. My proposal for all the banks that got a taxpayer-funded public bailout but still aren't lending anybody any money. My proposal for all the Wall Street investment bankers and hedge fund managers who got 8, 9, and even 10-figure bonuses over the last few years for profits that have now turned out to be completely illusory. My proposal for all the financial wizards who whipped up the frothy brew that intoxicated Americans with promises of pain-free, debt-propelled prosperity. My proposal is this: that you write a letter to the editor or post something on your blog asking people to tell you about their struggles. Then start writing some anonymous checks to tide people over until our economy can recover from your excesses. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich, and his latest book is Generation Ageless. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. There's lots more Smart City on our website, smartcityradio.com. You can subscribe to our podcast, sign up for our weekly newsletter, or drop us a line and let us know how we're doing. Click on the contact button or send us an email at questions@smartcityradio.com. Additional funding provided by the National Trust Main Street Center, revitalizing America's traditional business districts to build sustainable communities. Visit www.mainstreet.org. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer. He's got a headache for some reason. I'm Carol Coletta.